We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
No Maria today. She will be out probably for at least the next 3 weeks, could be a little longer due to the fabulous tax season that returns this time every year.
Yes, that's her secret day job.
Yeah. So, not to worry, there's still plenty happened that Jav will explain it all to us.
Yeah, it was an incredibly busy news week, and let's start with the Washington State Supreme Court decision that unanimously permitted the recall effort against City Council member Shama Sawant to go ahead. That does not automatically mean it will be on the ballot. The backers of the recall initiative have 180 days to collect a little over 10,000 signatures. That's a quarter of the registered voters in District 3. You know, you would expect that the usual suspects are behind this, which is to say the business community. The recall effort has, interestingly, not raised nearly as much money as Sawant has so far. But they also haven't started fundraising in earnest, and you don't see the usual business contributors behind the effort, at least not yet. That's probably strategic, and it's probably coming, but we'll see. Meanwhile, the Sawant effort was having a rally this morning at 11 o'clock. It may still be going on with sign-making and what have you at Cal Anderson Park on Capitol Hill. So if anybody is in that neighborhood and wants to check that out, it's probably still happening. I think Sawant, if this makes it to the ballot and the backers of the recall effort have said that they don't want to be on the ballot for the general election, and that would require their, getting the signatures certified pretty quickly, not in the 180 days. The 180 days would take it to the end of October. And you can't have a recall election on the ballot between the primary and the general election. So you're probably looking at a special election early next year. So that's a fair ways out. But first of all, they have to get the required signatures. And I would expect that, one of the main focuses of the rally this morning is to launch a decline to sign effort, because, of course, a lot of people will just sign whatever is put in front of them, and paid signature gatherers, which I'm sure they will use, are often not especially forthcoming about what that piece of paper you're supposed to sign actually says. So that will be an education campaign, and that will be the focus of the next several months, along with fundraising for any recall election. The concern here, at least if you support Sawant, is that it's going to be much more difficult, I think, for her to win an up or down question. Do you want Sawant removed or not? In the past, she's been reelected twice now, and both times she had relatively flawed candidates, Pamela Banks in 2015 and Egan Orion in 2019. Those candidates said some controversial things on the campaign trail, and that basically enabled Sawant to come from behind and win in both cases. In the Orion election in 2019, people may remember, it was very close. Orion was significantly ahead on election night, and Sawant made up the ground with late votes. It will be a real struggle for her to stay in office, honestly, if it gets on the ballot. And the organizers of the recall effort seem to have learned a lesson from 2019 when Sawant was able to make great use of the fact that Amazon poured money into Orion's campaign via the Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce PAC. It was portrayed as Amazon trying to buy the city council, because, of course, it wasn't just Sawant. They targeted progressive candidates in nearly every district, and those progressive candidates all won. So we'll see. You know, the concern in the Sawant camp has always been that since she was initially elected in 2013, the nature of what is now District 3, the Capitol Hill, and then east out to Lake Washington, has changed quite a bit. It's become incredibly gentrified, a very wealthy district, second only to the downtown district, District 7, which also includes Magnolia and Queen Anne. And that's going to make it very a bit more difficult for her brand of populist politics, which probably has more support toward the south end of Seattle and the U District and some of the other more progressive parts of town. So we'll see. We'll see how this plays out. But I think Sawant's going to need a lot of support over the next few months.
Side note, you mentioned Pamela Banks had run against her back in 2016, is that right?
2015.
It was interesting. I saw an article about, I think it was KOW that did a quick article about Jenny Durkin bringing back Pamela Banks. She's currently working. Pamela Banks is back in town. I didn't know she had left. Apparently she'd moved to Atlanta. I was back in Seattle working for the Durkin campaign as the interim director at EOD. And my initial thought when I saw the KOW article about her job there was that they were floating her. It was kind of a article to float the idea of, oh, here's another potential candidate running this, you know, throwing their hat in the ring this coming May. She probably is smart enough now not to want to get back into Seattle politics, especially with the lack of success she had last time. But, you know,
she said some pretty bigoted things during that campaign, and I suspect she doesn't want that brought back up.
Yeah. Well, you would think. And yet there are many people continue to throw their hats in the ring, regardless of what comes out of their mouth. So,
yes.
All right. Anything else on the Sawant recall effort?
No, let's move on.
Okay.
The next confusing news item this week was Compassion Seattle. That is the new charter amendment campaign being run apparently by Tim Burgess, the former conservative city council member and temporary mayor, who is widely suspected of wanting to run for mayor himself this year. But this may occupy his time instead. We'll see. The headlines on the charter, Compassion Seattle charter, are relatively misleading. Because the lead item is this would ban encampments in all public spaces for the homeless. And it's like, well, that sounds like a business community wet dream. But if you look at it more closely, it looks like, and I emphasize looks like because, you know, the proof will be in the pudding, it looks like the business community in Seattle has significantly shifted as a result of lessons learned during the pandemic, and frustration that the Durkin administration has turned down federal funding to help house homeless people in motel rooms and the like. Which we now know, thanks to various studies over the past year, are significant. It turns out that putting people in enclosed spaces where they have some privacy and can store their stuff helps get people off the street. Who would have thunk? Because the city's approach to homelessness, at least under Durkin and previously under Ed Murray and going back really 20 years, has been to try and get rid of encampments. And it looks like Compassion Seattle is designed to do that as well. But there's an important caveat to that. They're only supposed to ban the public encampments once enclosed spaces are available, and it makes a provision that people have to go to those willingly. So, you know, you can't put people in room closets and force them to stay there, for example. So the main downside to Compassion Seattle, and it has people backing it that that I trust who have that are have worked on homelessness for a long time. People like Lisa Daugaard, the public defender who has worked a lot on homelessness issues. It has requirements that the city provide things like drug treatments and other programs that will help get people off the street, and it mandates the city that they can't start removing encampments until people have places to go. It looks like, in other words, that the log jam of the last 20 years where you have homeless providers on one side, business community on the other, and excuse me. And the business community just wants to make it all disappear. It looks like the business community has finally figured out that, yes, you do have to spend money on permanent housing. You do have to plan for the long term, and that actually works. And nothing else obviously has worked. The city's policies have been counterproductive and failed for as long as I can remember on this issue, really going back to the 1980s. It will be very interesting to see how people receive this. There's been some pushback from the homelessness community already, in that the plan was drafted without their input. I think quite legitimately want a seat at the table. No plan for us without us, basically. So we'll see how that works. And we'll see how, whether it gets amended further, from input from the homeless community, for example, and whether it gets support from the public. If it gets sufficient signatures, once again, it would go on the ballot as a citywide charter amendment. The other downside and likely criticism of it, and this is from the other side, is that there's no funding for any of this. That would be up to city council and the mayor to provide funding. And even though it would be legally required that they provide funding, and we're talking about funding that would, for the programs that they lay out, probably take up about 12% of the city budget. So it's a significant chunk, which has got to come from somewhere, either from additional revenue, which temporarily that's available because we're getting money from the feds. The various business taxes are increasing in revenue as we come out of the pandemic. Permanently that's going to be a problem, and it's likely to face some pushback because of that as well. From the usual, anti-homeless folks who, once it's clear, what this is about, are likely to be aghast that the city is spending any money at all on this problem. So we'll see.
Yeah, it seems like it has numerous issues that are going to be really troublesome. One being the legal one with altering the city charter to, permanently push that 12% that they're asking for over towards their issues without their issues being clearly defined,
Yeah, it's true. There's certainly some, if you actually go and read the document, and I would encourage people to do that, one of the problems with it is lack of definitions. What constitutes permanent housing? They don't say. What constitutes available in terms of, what would trigger, the provision that bans public encampments? They don't say. So things like that really do need to be cleaned up. This may be version one, and, they'll have to come back with a revised version later. I don't know. They certainly haven't qualified it for, signature gathering yet. So they still have time to amend it.
Ah, okay. that will be interesting. I also know from my readings that a lot of the people, at least in the news articles that have been covering this, a lot of the people and organizations that have presented as being supportive of it have, in fact, participated early on in giving their honest feedback for if an amendment like this was pushed forward. And that doesn't necessarily to equate to those same organizations necessarily supporting the end product that is, you know, finally presented to the public.
Yeah, for one thing, they haven't had time to respond to it yet in terms of, like, board approval and things like that. So, that has been muddied a little bit. I don't think the media coverage on this has been particularly good, honestly, locally. Danny Westneat had a good column in the Seattle Times that explained it, but the Seattle Times, reporting on it was, it emphasized the banning encampment in public places and didn't really go into the nuance of it in very much detail. And as you say, they were quoting people as representative of organizations that have not, in fact, endorsed this.
Yeah, and as what often happens in corporate media, including quotes that with no day or time that those quotes were made, you don't know, reading it, whether that quote was in the last few days from when this was launched or if that quote was from, like, you know, last year when they were working on this issue. So it's always an interesting read when you actually engage critical thinking.
Yeah, media literacy is badly undertaught in this country. Let's leave it at that.
I don't think it's taught at all.
No.
So, something that maybe we can get on next year's state legislative agenda.
There you go.
All right. Okay. Let's move on then to local issues, local updates related to the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, the big news this week was the state announced, I think on Wednesday, that effective April 15th, all adults in Washington State will be eligible for vaccine. So we are less than 2 weeks away from that. And at that point, anybody who wants a vaccine can go get one. And I saw a release from the U.S. Census Bureau this week. Yes, I'm a geek. I get their press releases. They did a survey, and of the 15 largest metropolitan areas in the country, Seattle has the highest percentage of people who have not yet been vaccinated who want to get a vaccine. It was well over 90%, which is really encouraging. For people who are curious, it was Riverside, San Bernardino that was at the bottom of that list. So there has been great demand, and according to the state, they will have enough vaccine to meet the demand by next week. That's why the April 15th date was picked, so it gives them time to distribute it to local vaccinators. So if you want a vaccine and you haven't gotten one yet, just wait a couple weeks and you will be able to get one. There's a number of places locally now that are making that available. That list is at the Seattle King County Health website, and there's also a vaccine finder app that you can access through the state health department. So that was very good news locally. The bad news is that we are well into our fourth wave, both locally and nationally, and Washington State is one of the three dozen or so states where cases are rising, and the place they're rising most is in Puget Sound, Washington, in Pierce, King, and Snohomish counties. So the pandemic is not over yet. Keep wearing a mask. Keep social distancing. Keep washing your hands. These are things that will continue to help prevent the spread. And both locally and nationally, that spread seems concentrated Since so many seniors have been vaccinated at this point, it's younger demographics that have been responsible for the spread. And, of course, we have a number of variants in the Puget Sound area as well. We've seen clusters arising at the University of Washington, for example, among students there, you know, as frat parties continue. So, you know, don't get complacent. We're almost there. You know, I think we are likely to be dealing with COVID as a chronic infection problem in our society for some time to come. But in terms of being able to, you know, quote unquote, resume normalcy, whatever that is, for some of us who don't aren't really very normal to begin with, that is coming. But we're not there yet. We don't have anything close to herd immunity yet. And we're still seeing the virus spread quite rapidly, actually, among younger demographics. And, you know, people under the age of 50 who get COVID can still get sick and die. It's still a serious concern. So, I saw a thing this week where vehicular traffic, not just in Seattle, but nationally, has resumed pre-pandemic levels for the first time. And that's not a good sign because we're not out of the pandemic yet. So
The University of Washington, so they're not physically back in session yet. So it's just the, and you'd mentioned the frats, and those had been hot spots prior, at least on two occasions. So are you saying there was actually something in the last week or two where they had another flare up of, you know, 100 plus people?
Exactly.
Okay. I gotta check that out. I missed that one.
Yeah. And they don't invite you to their parties either. I mean, what's up with that?
Well, that goes back long before the pandemic.
Yes. That goes back to high school, in fact, where you weren't invited, yeah. Which was what, 20 years ago?
Oh, I wish. All right. Sorry to derail. Please continue.
Let's talk about national developments. The CDC and FDA have been busy this week. The CDC came out with yet another new guidance yesterday, saying basically that air travel is fine now, as long as you wear a mask, socially distance if the airline will let you, if they're not cramming their flights full, you should be fine.
To be fair, they still said they wouldn't recommend you do it. They say you can do it, but we recommend you don't.
Yeah.
They did. Which tends to get left out in when people are quoting that, you know?
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, I mean, and that's natural because, you know, people quote what they want to hear, and what they hear is that it's safe to fly. It really isn't, you know, particularly because, you know, flights go all over the place and they can go to states that are experiencing severe outbreaks like Michigan and New York and some of those other states that are Florida that are, you know, having a really rough time right now. And, you know, Washington State isn't there. They aren't among the worst states, but they're kind of in the next tier at this point. We are not safe either. Flights leaving from Seattle, yeah, they have people from Seattle in them, or people from Washington State anyway. So I wouldn't recommend it, certainly. So anyway, the CDC came out with that yesterday, which seemed, you know, as much intended to please the airline industry as anything. The other significant development this week in terms of regulation was from the FDA, which said that a couple of at-home COVID tests that were available previously by prescription now can be bought over the counter. So you can test for COVID yourself, which I guess is good and bad. It certainly makes it more available, and we'll see what the cost is and how many people avail themselves of it. What I would want to know is, does that get reported to your local county or state, or not? You know, are we going to lose track of how many people actually test positive? Because somebody tests positive, they say, oh, I got to stay home for 2 weeks. And they stay home for 2 weeks and nobody else knows about it. You know, that is my concern about that. At the same time, it's very good that those are being made available and are relatively easy to use. So, look for that at your local pharmacy.
Any word on if those will be something that is, paid for, covered by federal or state funding? Again, that kind of becomes a privileged item out there for the people that can afford to buy those and, you know, have them shipped.
Well, I've been waiting for the press release from Insurance Commissioner Mike Kriegler in Washington State, and I would expect that it will come next week saying, yes, health insurance has to cover this. So we'll see what happens with that. That would be a big help. Because, you know, obviously with over-the-counter stuff, generally health insurance does not cover it. You have to pay for it out of pocket. And it does become a privileged thing. So we'll see.
Yeah, because, again, a regular theme of this whole pandemic was, you know, that announcement that we have vaccines available. You can now sign up. And then, of course, they're not available to everybody. They're only available to a very limited amount of people. And, oh, by the way, we also sent out an email to our funders a few days ago, and they're already here getting their shots, so we can assure you the whole system's working out great.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So FDA home testing.
Yes.
Coming.
So the big news really is that the country as a whole is making great progress on vaccinations. We saw an interesting milestone this week that the state of Louisiana became the first state to have fewer cases this week than it did at the same time last year. The bad news is that no other state is close to that, and that overall the United States is still recording four times the number of daily cases, new daily cases, that it was, you know, this time last year, which was, of course, in the middle of the big first spring wave, where everything was shut down. We aren't shutting everything down now. Of course, we have a significant portion of the population that is vaccinated at this point. Something like three quarters of seniors across the country are have had at least one vaccination, and more than 50% have had both shots. So they're fully vaccinated. So that's very good news. And we're seeing hospitalizations and deaths among seniors decline quite a bit. We're seeing the effects of that. That's the good news. The bad news is that cases are up, hospitalizations are up, deaths are steady to rising. That's kind of a lagging indicator because it takes people time to die, which is, you know, really inconvenient for statistical purposes, but there you go. You know, we're states are still hell-bent on opening everything up. This does not seem like a good idea until we have more people vaccinated. But people are impatient. They're tired of the pandemic. God knows we're tired of talking about it. But we're going to keep talking about it because it's important and because a lot of people are dying. So that's the state of play in the United States. We at least have a federal government that is trying to take the pandemic seriously. That's the positive. And really, the number of people that have been vaccinated in a relatively short period of time has been remarkable. And we lost the first month of that because the Trump administration had no plan. And you wonder at this point how many lives would have been saved if the vaccine had been made widely available at the first time that it was rolled out and approved in early to mid December. Instead, this federal government didn't get serious about it until January 20th. And since then, they've done a relatively good job of getting the vaccine out. We had a setback this week because a manufacturing subcontractor in Baltimore who is making Johnson & Johnson's vaccine for the rollout of their now approved one-shot vaccine, had a mix-up with an ingredient that was intended for an AstraZeneca vaccine, which is not yet available in the U.S. And so they lost 15 million doses, which is a lot. So it turns out that the manufacturer had a number of complaints stemming from a previous FDA inspection last year. And not only did the federal government not do anything about those complaints, but the Trump administration turned around and handed into them a very lucrative subcontract for making vaccines when they came out. So that, once again, that's an unfortunate setback in terms of availability of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But it's traceable to the previous guy, as are so many of the problems in the federal government right now. We'll see how that impacts vaccine availability in Washington State. The health department doesn't seem to think it'll be a major issue. We'll see.
Do you want to nuke that?
Let me move my buzzing phone away from the microphone. Okay.
All right. Global, worldwide issues regarding COVID that were of note? Any?
Well, Brazil continues to be a basket case. They are up to 325,000 deaths now. It's by far the worst outbreak anywhere in the world right now. India is suffering a new wave because they had it more or less under control, at least as much as you can with 1.4 billion people in your country. But it's exploding there again as well. And we're seeing a serious outbreak in Western Europe, particularly France, is now the fourth most cases in the world. And their effort to contain the pandemic really seems to have fallen apart, mostly through widespread noncompliance with government restrictions. And it'd be interesting to read an analysis of what's brought that about. I haven't looked into it in depth. I just know that the numbers there are really, really bad. And the government has, as it has in many European governments, have locked down part or all of their country. But that's certainly going on in France right now. Also parts of Germany, Poland, Italy has been in lockdown for the last several weeks. Italy's had a lot of cases recently as well. Some places you wouldn't expect that you don't hear much about, like Hungary, Croatia. These are smaller countries, so they don't rack up the numbers, but as a per capita thing, they're still very high in infections. And much of this is being driven by the British 117 variant, which appears to be extremely contagious, as well as having a higher mortality rate. We've seen that in some states in the U.S., particularly Florida. We have a lot of variants in Washington State, but so far they haven't really exploded. There's a major 117 outbreak going on in Vancouver, B.C. right now. British Columbia is one of the Canadian provinces that has done a relatively good job in containing the virus, unlike, say, Ontario, which went into another lockdown this week because cases there have been spiking. So Canada is still struggling with it as well. Canada was one of two countries that reached a million overall cases this week. There are now 23 of them out of 192, I believe, countries that have had the pandemic. There are still countries, mostly island countries in the South Pacific, that have not had any COVID cases at all, which is pretty remarkable.
Surprised the billionaires aren't snapping up land there.
You don't know that they aren't.
Speaking of the British variant, how are things faring in the UK?
They're slowly getting better. Some of the lockdown measures that the Johnson government undertook last month have been lifted now. New cases and hospitalizations are slowing. The British health system is not overwhelmed by hospitalizations at this point. But the lockdowns really help. Just stop going out, stop going to work, at least in offices. Stop going to your pub in the evening in the case of Britain. That helps a lot. Social distancing makes a big difference. Mask wearing, again, makes a big difference as well, as does washing your hands. Those are the three pillars that we know work, but people don't do them because they are impatient to get back to life as quote-unquote normal.
What vaccines are they using there, and are they finding that to be adequate for dealing with the British variant?
Britain has had, yes, so far. Britain has had one of the best vaccination rates in the world. They've vaccinated over half their population at this point. And so they've had a very efficient vaccine rollout. And they have, let me think, they have authorized, I believe, four different vaccines in the UK, as opposed to the three that they've vaccinated here, plus the AstraZeneca, which is the dominant one there since it was originally developed by Oxford University. So that's their homegrown vaccine. They have rolled out the vaccine very effectively. That's been one of the factors in slowing it down. And that's been one of the factors that has been more problematic in places like France, is that they've had a very inefficient vaccine rollout. The vaccines at this point have been around for long enough that you're starting to see them have an impact in the overall numbers in countries where there has been a mass rollout. There are a number of countries, particularly in Sub-Saharan Africa, that have not had any vaccine availability yet. And that's disturbing. We're not hearing much about Africa in the news, but places like Nigeria are seeing significant outbreaks, Egypt also. And some countries just don't have a very good infrastructure for reporting cases, so we really have no idea how bad it is in those countries.
But again, for Africa, that's still following the Western colonialism model in choosing not to distribute vaccines to.
It's not that they can't distribute, it's that the, companies like Pfizer and Moderna want to sell the vaccines, and the wealthy countries have snapped up all the availabilities,
right?
And the poorer countries can't afford it anyway. So the poorer countries have been relying on a program called COVAX, which is being run through the World Health Organization to distribute vaccines to poorer countries, and that. That program has been enormously helpful in some countries, particularly places like Ghana and Nigeria, but it hasn't gotten to a number of other countries yet. So that's concerning. It just hasn't had the vaccine available to that program. So the problem really is with the pharmaceutical companies who are manufacturing these vaccines, what they are charging for the vaccines, as opposed to making them available for the betterment of humanity and trying to end a global pandemic that has now cost nearly 3 million lives globally.
Okay. Anything else on COVID for this week? Or?
No, we had a lot of national news. Let's get on to that.
Okay. Let's start with the trial that was getting a lot of attention this week.
Yeah.
As well it should. Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who murdered George Floyd, I'm not even going to say allegedly, went on trial this week starting on Tuesday, and boy, what a trial. A lot of it was televised by cable news, and so far this week you saw opening arguments and initial witnesses by the prosecution. There will be more prosecution witnesses next week, followed by the defense. And then closing arguments, and then the jury has to decide. And I am going to go way out on a limb and predict that the jury is going to find the dude guilty. We saw the initial arguments by the defense. Basically, the takeaway from the trial so far is that the murder of George Floyd was a lot worse than you thought. We got that from a number of directions, and we didn't get anything to mitigate that conclusion, really. The defense arguments seem to be, first of all, that we don't know what killed George Floyd. It might have been the drugs in his system. It might have been a heart condition. Who knows? Well, we do know because the medical examiner already ruled that it was a homicide. So that's easily countered. Although I'm sure the defense will produce quote unquote expert witnesses that that say otherwise. Secondly, this was what Chauvin was trained to do by his police department. This was Minneapolis Police Department protocol. Yesterday we had a witness, the head of the homicide division in Minneapolis, a guy named Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, who testified under oath that no, in fact, this was excessive force. That Minneapolis police are permitted to use a knee on the neck, but only in what he called, tier one situations. In other words, the most extreme needs to restrain a suspect. In Zimmerman's view, this was excessive force. This was not protocol at all. And, you don't need excessive force on somebody who is already lying face down on the sidewalk with his hands handcuffed behind his back. He did not need restraint. Beyond that, even if that were permissible, it was only permissible for the first few minutes until Zimmerman was, not resisting. Well, of course, after about 6 minutes, Zimmerman was not only not resisting, he was passed out. And then, of course, he died. All Chauvin needed to do at any point in that interminable 9 minutes and 26 seconds, we saw the body cam footage of that incident this week, and it was truly harrowing. All he needed to do was lift his freaking knee. All he needed to do at any point after that was check his pulse or allow somebody else to do it. There was an EMT in the crowd of bystanders who were yelling, "You're murdering him." So it's not like he didn't know that there were concerns about the guy's health. He was just completely indifferent to it. And you saw that in the body cam footage afterwards where he was acting like it was just another day at the office. Meanwhile, some of those bystander witnesses were on the stand this week as well. And most of them at one point or another broke down sobbing, and they're saying they were feeling so guilty because there was nothing they could do, because the other three police officers were primarily engaged in keeping the crowd away so that Chauvin could murder this guy. We also found out through surveillance footage from the store that Zimmerman had allegedly passed a counterfeit bill at that the clerk there said he...
Wait,
he,
not Zimmerman.
Zimmerman. No, we're off of Zimmerman. The clerk at the store testified under oath that... he thought that it was Zimmerman's buddy who was in the car while this was happening, but had gone into the store previously with Zimmerman, that he thought that was the guy probably who had given Zimmerman the bill, and he didn't think Zimmerman even knew that the bill was counterfeit. So so that raises the prospect that you're killing an innocent guy. So it just got worse and worse and worse as the week went on. I don't know. Obviously the defense attorneys, what they get paid to do is try and present the best possible case for getting their client off. But I don't see how they're going to be able to do it. It looks really damning at this point. And, at this point, I would have to say that the people who burned down the precinct that Chauvin worked out of, had the right idea because that was a seriously, disturbing, trial so far.
All right. Let's move on then to developments this week with the state of Georgia.
Yeah, Georgia and Texas which is considering a very similar voter suppression law to the one that was signed into law in Georgia last week. And we started to see significant blowback from corporate America this week. In Georgia, Coca-Cola, which is headquartered in Atlanta and is basically considered the way Amazon is here, what they want, they usually get. They came out in opposition to the voter suppression law. You know, I don't know what kind of impact that will have, given that it's already become law. The Republican-dominated state legislature has been very defiant so far in their responses to these criticisms. The first one was Delta Airlines, which is also a major employer in Atlanta. The Atlanta airport is the busiest in the world, and Delta is one of two big airlines, Eastern being the other, that uses that as its hub. So they have a lot of jobs in Georgia as well. You know, so far, and of course, you know, Republicans in Georgia rely on them for a lot of their donations, as is true in much of the country, where they rely on big companies to float their agendas. So Delta came out with a criticism, their CEO, and then the CEO of Coca-Cola within a day had done the same. And then yesterday, Major League Baseball pulled its All-Star game and pulled its draft from Atlanta this summer, which is a big deal in Atlanta. You have to understand something about Atlanta specifically, which is kind of unique among American cities, which is they became a major city almost specifically because of Major League sports. You know, the Atlanta Braves were the first team to move there in, I think, 1966 or something. And then, you know, they've had all three other major league leagues in their city at one point or another, and it really turned them into a place that people considered a major city. Before that, it was sort of a sleepy state capital in the South, sort of like another Birmingham or Memphis that wasn't really a top tier American city. It was sort of the next tier down. So that's a big part of their identity. That and civil rights and Coca-Cola, basically. Those are their gifts to the world. So Major League Baseball making that statement not only served as a major rebuke to the Georgia legislators, but it also served as a warning to places like Texas and Arizona and other states where these voter rights initiatives being pushed by Republicans appear likely to get signed into law. We also saw pushback in Texas this week. Southwest Airlines, American Airlines, Dell Computers all came out criticizing a major voter suppression bill that in some ways is even more ambitious than Georgia's that looks likely to pass the legislature in Texas and get signed into law by Governor Abbott. So there's a major campaign afoot at this point to get corporate America to to criticize and express their disapproval and stop spending money in some of these states that pass these bills. And of course it's going to get harder to do if you have a large number of states that pass them, but it's difficult to see, particularly taking the Georgia example, since that's the one concrete one where it's become law, where legislators are going to want to walk this back unless the composition of the legislatures are changed, radically. And, that does not appear, thanks to gerrymandering, which the Supreme Court ruled legal, that does not appear likely to happen anytime soon. Particularly since the gerrymandering is controlled in many of these states by the state legislatures. And, as we've talked about in the past, you get these modern, software programs that can really allow, elected officials to pick who is going to vote for them as opposed to, voters picking who their legislators will be. Now legislators are being able to pick their voters. And in the case of Georgia, it's very extreme because if those voters don't vote the way they want to, they can still override the results. It's a jaw-droppingly anti-democratic piece of law, and the state of Texas goes even farther in that direction, which is really disturbing. Because of course, Texas is another state that where the changing demographics suggests that Democrats may have the upper hand soon. They certainly do in all the major cities at this point. If the state legislators can say, nope, that election isn't valid, we want to pick the other candidate, so that's what we're going to do. That is what leads to a one-party state. That's what leads to autocracy, dictatorships, loss of democracy. It's a very disturbing trend. And the Republican Party at this point doesn't seem interested in legislating either at the state or congressional level with any of the actual problems that government needs to help fix. They're more concerned about power and staying in power and ending democracy in order to do it. And we've seen that already in Georgia, and we're seeing that in process and very close to being signed into law, particularly in Texas and Arizona and Iowa.
Yeah, and the problem of gerrymandering is, of course, exacerbated by the fact that both parties generally support it. You know, they were fine.
We see that in Washington State, where in some ways the way that congressional districts are drawn up is among the fairest of any state in the country. It's a bipartisan commission, and both parties have to sign off on it. Well, what that's led to is not so much favoring one party, as you see in places like Texas and North Carolina, as favoring incumbents. So you get districts drawn that are designed to protect Democrats in seats that Democrats currently hold and protect Republicans in seats that Republicans currently hold. It just so happens that Washington is a blue enough state that over the years, Democrats have won more of those states. For example, the 8th district on the east side used to be a Republican stronghold. Well, changing demographics on that east side imperiled Dave Riker's hold on power. So in 2010, they redrew the district to include Kittitas County and parts of Chelan County on the east side that are more Republican, so they could try and save Riker's seat. Well, Riker held onto his seat until he retired in 2018, and at that point, the seat went over to the Democrats. We're seeing the same kind of thing go on in Southwest Washington, which is becoming more Democratic, but Jamie Herrera Butler has a hold on that seat because it's been designed as a Republican district. So it includes not only Vancouver, which is getting more and more people coming from metropolitan Portland, but it also includes places like Longview, Kelso, Lewis County, places like that that are solidly Republican. So, Washington State is a good example of that.
Moving on, continued mass shootings this week.
Yeah, and knifings. We had the attack on the U.S. Capitol yesterday, where one Capitol policeman was killed, another was seriously wounded by a guy who appeared to have mental health problems. He seemed to believe that the CIA and FBI were targeting him for mind control. And that's what led him to attack the Capitol and attack Capitol policemen, first by ramming him with his car and then coming out and lunging at them with a knife before he, in turn, was shot dead. What looked a lot like suicide by cop, honestly. That does seem to be a one-off incident. It was not a right-wing attack, which is what people were first concerned about. Meanwhile, the suspect in the Boulder shootings last week is being held now for a mental health evaluation. He killed 10 people, you remember, at a supermarket in Boulder, including one policeman. And so his next court appearance, I believe, will be May 25th. So it's going to be a while he is held for mental health evaluation and no bail. We haven't heard a whole lot about the suspect in Georgia from the shootings 2 weeks ago. Meanwhile, we had another mass shooting in Orange, California, near it's just north of Anaheim, in an office complex that appears to be have arisen from a domestic dispute. The suspect in that case was wounded. He killed four people, including a 9-year-old boy, and he himself was wounded in an exchange of gunfire with police. He is a young Hispanic male, young male, of course, being the common through line with all these suspects. They all have survived also, which is interesting, except for, of course, from the attacker yesterday. The mass shooting in Orange was actually the 20th in the United States since the shooting 2 weeks ago in Atlanta, 2.5 weeks ago, which really underscores how endemic gun violence is in the United States and how desperately we need legislatures to do something about it, particularly making it harder to or impossible to get weapons of war, assault weapons with high capacity magazines. That's what's fueling a lot of these body counts, because you can kill multiple people in seconds. It's something that is primarily being blocked by Republicans, both at the federal and the state level, and the gun fetish lobby. Even though the NRA is significantly less powerful than it was, because it's facing all kinds of legal problems, we've talked about that in past episodes. But these past 3 weeks have really underscored how endemic gun violence is in the United States and how desperately we need to do something about it. I'll leave it at that.
All right. And then finally, the International Criminal Court, got a little boost this week from the Biden administration.
Yeah, the Biden administration quietly announced yesterday in the middle of a very a major news day that it was lifting the sanctions that Trump had imposed on the chief prosecutor for the International Court, individual sanctions preventing that person from traveling to the U.S. That was in retaliation for the prosecutor trying to investigate war crimes by U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Now, the U.S. is not a signatory to the ICC, so it's not subject to ICC jurisdiction. But I would think that if the ICC is interested in investigating U.S. war crimes, that it really ought to take a close look at the last guy in office, because he is vulnerable to multiple counts on that front. And so far, Biden has been better, but the history of the last pretty much every U.S. president since World War I, maybe, has been violating international law and human rights. So we'll see how Biden does. But Trump was spectacularly bad on that score, just like a lot of his dictator buddies are. So we'll see how that goes. But that was good news to see that the Biden administration, it has a huge job in trying to undo all the bad things that their predecessors did. So that project's going to go on for a while.
Yeah, agreed. But also when that's the gold standard of just changing what the previous president did, we're still coming out in the world of hurt.
Yeah, and the U.S. has not become a signatory to the ICC specifically because it has to be, as a treaty, it has to be ratified by the Senate. And the Senate Republicans have blocked that consideration of that for nearly 20 years now. So that's been the problem there. It's not just the previous presidents.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time for this week. But there's next week.
There is next week. And if it was anything like this week, we'll have plenty to talk about again.
All right. Well, we will talk to you then.
Sounds good.